Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Well, today is the third Monday of the month, which means on Conversations Live that we explore alternative career options and viable lifestyles. And I say that because I don't think you can have a lifestyle without a career. I think the career influences the lifestyle, no matter how much you try not to let it. So if you're tired of clocking in and out and working on someone else's schedule, or you'd like more freedom to choose maybe the type of projects you work on and when you work on them, then this is the show for you. Today, we're exploring what it takes to create a successful freelance lifestyle. And we're going to talk with two Seattle-based freelancers. And I specifically chose Seattle-based freelancers because we want to know what the market's like here, too. And both of them have learned firsthand about the ups and downs, what it takes to not just survive, but to thrive as a free agent. And we'll even find out if they really do work in PJs and bunny slippers. That's a question I get asked all the time. Do you really work in your PJs and bunny slippers? Coming up at 12:40, we'll talk with freelance photojournalist, visual storyteller, and filmmaker Marcus Donner. But first, let me introduce Michelle Goodman. Michelle has been freelancing for 16 years as a journalist and writer and knows firsthand what it takes to balance the creative lifestyle with the important thing of keeping a roof over her head. Her articles and essays about alternative careers, human mating rituals, and cultural trends have graced media outlets such as abcnews.com, cnn.com, salon.com, the Seattle Times, and the list goes on. And she's the author of two books. Her first is called The Anti-9-to-5 Guide, Practical Career Advice for Women Who Think Outside the Cube. And her newest book is called My So-Called Freelance Life, How to Survive and Thrive as a Creative Professional for Hire. Michelle Goodman, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. And I'm glad you could join us because I really did want to get somebody who was local to the area, and then I came across your book, so that was even better.
Perfect. And I would like you to know that I'm actually wearing sock monkey slippers.
Well, that's answered one question, right? I know I get asked that all the time when people find I work out of my home studio a lot. It's like, do you really wear PJs and bunny slippers? And I'm like, well, I don't have any bunny slippers. So that kind of answers that question, right?
Yeah, I have an assortment now. People just give them to me as presents all the time. It's kind of funny.
So you wrote this book, Michelle, your latest one. I have to ask you, first of all, it's called My So-Called Freelance Life. Why so-called?
Well, I just like the sound of it, and I guess it was sort of a play off that TV show, My So-Called Life, from the 90s. And, you know, it is sort of a nod to all those folks who ask freelancers in their first few years, the family and friends that say, when are you going to get a real job? And then after, you know, 3 or 5 years, when they realize this isn't a phase, this person is actually making a living, and this person actually is finding jobs, excuse me, a lot more quickly than I am, and in some cases, they start coming to you for advice. So it was just a twist, I guess.
Yeah. And you wrote this book, you said, for anyone who's hit the snooze button 5 times in a row on Monday morning. Now, I'm assuming you've been there.
Yeah, and I won't, you know, truth be told, occasionally I am still there. I mean, not every project is glorious. But yes, I was not fond of the commute and office life. And, you know, when I was working in an office, I thought 9 a.m. was the middle of the night. So I was not great at being cheering on the subway at 8 a.m. And, you know, just, yeah.
Yeah. So, just tell us so we have an idea of what you used to do. What had you used to do when you lived in Cubicle World?
I was in the Cube World for 3 years outside of college, and I first worked as a community newspaper reporter in LA and a bureau chief And then and that was for a year. And then for a year and a half or so, there was a period of unemployment in there for a few months while I was transitioning. I moved to the East Coast. And so for a year and a half, after I got a job, I worked as a publicist at a book publishing company in New York. And my transition to self-employment was not very well planned or graceful. I just, kind of did a Scarlett O'Hara, shook my fist to the sky, and was like, as God is my witness, I will never have a day job again. And I talk about all the mistakes I would advise people to not make that I made in both books. Just there was not a lot of forethought that went into it. And, freelancing, working for yourself is 50% of it is running a business. I mean, the talent or the skill that people are hiring you to do, whether it's bookkeeping or photojournalism, is, that's really just half of it. And in the beginning, I had the business savvy of like a German shepherd or golden retriever. So I had to learn on the fly. But fortunately, it's not, it's not rocket science. It's just invoicing and marketing and all those fun things that go into keeping a business humming.
Right. There is a huge part of that, and I want to get into that in a minute. But let's look at some of the careers where people can freelance now, because, typically it used to be, somebody's a freelance writer or a freelance photographer. But nowadays, I work with so many people who are free agents in every kind of technology field, whether they're designing games or programming. What about you? What kind of careers have you come across?
Absolutely technology. But, there are business consultants. In certain fields, people might not use the word freelance, but, many, many family counselors and therapists and massage therapists work for themselves. And, they probably... they won't necessarily say freelance. I mean, that term is, something that just kind of goes with certain technical and creative professions. But, a business of one, it's all the same, whether you call it freelancing or free agent or being a sole proprietor. Other things people do there's everything from, like, pet grooming to, being like a home health care aide, all kinds of financial things, whether you're bookkeeping or you're a CPA or an accountant for small businesses. Virtual assistant is a hot new career. That can encompass any, it doesn't have to just be administrative. I mean, it can be web promotion and helping people with their blogs and a little bit of editing and a little bit of design and, so there's all sorts of things. It's definitely not just the tech and the creative sectors. It's just any office support role, but also like any service you could be providing someone to support their business, whether it's the financial or the consulting, or any service you could be providing to support them in their home, whether it's, concierge or dog walking or just about anything you can think of.
Right. Now, you've been doing this like 15, 16 years now.
Yes.
You said that you didn't plan your transition very smoothly, but you do outline in the book, give some recommendations there. I wonder if you'd share a couple of recommendations with us for somebody who's maybe in the corporate world and just wanting to get out of that cube.
Well, this probably goes without saying, but you shouldn't, just quit your job and expect to have a full freelance schedule tomorrow. While you're at the job with the paycheck, if you are still at a job, if you're laid off, that's a different story. But while you're still at the job with the paycheck, you can, if there is any way to cut back on spending even further than you already have, if there's any way to save a little money because your first few freelance months could be lean, there's that, and collecting contacts, collecting work samples or testimonials, just anything you're going to be able to put in your portfolio, and any people you're going to be able to call on for work later. So that's something. If you don't know anything about business, read a blog, read a book. You can take a class for a day for under $100 at SCORE, which is score.org. They provide all kinds of great very low-cost counseling and classes to small business owners. So there's, getting all your ducks in a row before you jump. Definitely setting up a website for yourself and doing an email blast or social network blast if you're on Facebook or LinkedIn, and telling everybody you're now accepting clients.
Let me ask you a question about social networking, because I just went to a couple of different conferences, actually, or a couple of seminars, and they were both on social networking. How important do you find places like Facebook and MySpace and LinkedIn to your business?
Well, I think the jury's still out, but I definitely, I think MySpace is kind of more useful if you're in a band.
Right, right.
LinkedIn is, super buttoned up and professional, and I think everybody should have a profile on LinkedIn, but some people will say they feel like it's too starch shirt for them. So mm-hmm. then, Facebook would be okay. I use LinkedIn and Facebook. I definitely pick up some, I use it to promote my books mm-hmm. and drive people to my blog. And also it can be helpful for new editors I'm working with at publications to just, quickly see, get my experience on LinkedIn. But Facebook is kind of more of fun thing. But with Facebook, you can set up a group and, you can kind of promote yourself a little bit there if you have some sort of product or mission that you're promoting. So there is that. I think it's a nice addendum, but no one thing is going to be the be-all, end-all. I mean, I don't think any of it takes the place of a website, but they all have interesting little features. I mean, inviting people to events through Facebook is kind of neat. And I have I have a web page for my new book on Facebook, so that's kind of cool. And, every time somebody joins it, all their friends see it, so it's kind of a viral thing.
Right.
That goes
right.
beyond what the blog I have does.
Right. Well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Michelle Goodman. Her new book is called My So-Called Freelance Life, How to Survive and Thrive as a Creative Professional for Hire. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming Monday, December 1st, on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Reverend Maria Dancingheart shares her views on the last adventure of life. She says dying can be a cause for joy, and the truth is that letting go is liberating. Maria Dancingheart explores new ways to view spirituality and death. She'll discuss the power of trust to heal and how love is the only real power any of us have. We'll also be talking to Catherine Neville, best-selling author of The Eight, about her new novel, The Fire, and why it took 20 years to write. That's all coming Monday, December 1st at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. We're talking to Seattle-based Michelle Goodman this morning. She's a freelancer, been freelancing for about 16 years. She's a journalist and writer, and her new book is called My So-Called Freelance Life, How to Survive and Thrive as a Creative Professional for Hire. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about, what to do before you quit your job. And I think if you know who Harvey McKay is, Michelle, he has a saying, I think he actually had a book called Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. And so that's really what you're talking about there, is getting all of your resources lined up, know what the market's like, know who your contacts are, and start building all of that before you actually quit your job.
Yes, I think you can. I mean, a lot of people fall into this because they get laid off, but then suddenly you have the time to focus on it.
Yeah. So what kind of things, tell us some of the biggest mistakes you made when you very first started out, because I think we learn a lot by reading about or listening to other people's mistakes.
Yeah. One that impacted my business the most, and I wrote about this a lot in the book, was not having clearly delineated terms with clients. You know, in the beginning, I didn't even have contracts on some occasions. So, it's not even just to have a deadline for you. It's to have a deadline for when the client for when you tell the client, okay, I'm not going to be available to you anymore. You know, no more revisions or no more calls. You know, I've given you your allotted time. And without that, a project can drag on for weeks or months beyond what you thought it would. And if you don't have it clearly outlined when you're going to get paid and, you know, tied to different milestones in the project, you might find yourself just, you know, continuing to work with this person that's sapping the life out of you just because right. you're waiting to get the money. So I made the mistake of not having super clear contracts in the beginning. But, you know, every seasoned independent professional will tell you that with every year they add something new to their contracts because a new circumstance comes up, which, you know, they feel like they need to cover in the mm-hmm. future. But that was huge because that sapped time and money for me as well as was frustrating. So that was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think some of the most common myths are that people have about the freelance life? And I think one of them is that you just work when you feel like it.
Yeah, so you work when you feel like it. And then on the flip side, that you work all the time, which is actually more true than the you work when you feel like it. People don't realize that if you don't make a set schedule, it can be very hard to motivate yourself. And then your clients may not take you seriously because they never know when they can reach you. The myths are, they include, everything's peachy. It's just the greatest job in the world. I'm not going to say it's not. I mean, I would obviously rather be doing this than, going back to the office life I had before. But just like any job, there are ups and downs. I think people also embrace the negative myths and get turned off or afraid of working for themselves because they think, oh, how will I ever get anyone to pay me? Aren't I going to have to be chasing down my checks all the time? And, mm-hmm. Will I ever be able to get anything done, or will I just watch soap operas all day? Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good point, because I think you can get drawn into, people will want to blame the market or want to blame this. Now, you're local, you're here in Seattle.
Yes.
Have you found the current economic situation affecting things here for you as a freelancer?
Yes. I wrote a blog post about this a week or so ago, but I outlined all the changes I was seeing in my schedule right now, but these could have happened on any given year. I mean, I have there's a lot of changes going on in the local media in Seattle, obviously, layoffs at a big paper up here, a prominent magazine just merged with another parent company, I think last week. So that's affected me and some of my friends. I've had projects, stalled, but that happens all the time, recession or no. And then I've had new clients come out of the woodwork, or old clients I haven't worked with in a couple years ask me to work with them. And it's kind of just typical of any freelancer. But I think, the way to ensure that you're not in dire straits is to not have any one client dominate more than 30% of your schedule or workload. So you're not, if that client does dry up, you still have 70% of the rest of your schedule full. And to really diversify, if you are like me, a writer, or, I know you're talking to a photojournalist later, if you are just working for the media, maybe don't just work for the media. Even if it's, just once a quarter you do a corporate job, at least you have this other way of making money if the bottom falls out and mm-hmm. suddenly your best clients are disappearing. So really, really diversifying. And diversifying your skills, too. I mean, I don't just write. I will edit and do consulting and teaching. I mean, writing is the bulk of my work. But just, you know, the more ways you have of making money and the more people, the more pans you have in the fire. I mean, I definitely have far more contacts and I'm staying in touch with far more clients than I could possibly work for. And I just kind of rotate them.
Right. And so, I think that's another good point, because I remember when I first moved up here and I was actually a student, but I started freelancing to make a bit of money. And I was prepared to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I have run into people who say, oh, well, I won't do this and I won't do that. And I think you can't really afford to limit yourself like that, at least until you're established.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have things I don't, you know, I just no longer do. But
right,
if
right.
I had no way of making money, I would do them.
Right.
right. But yeah, I think you need some fallbacks and bread and butter work. And, you know, it's not realistic in any market to come out as a freelancer and say, I only want to, you know, design websites for authors, or I only want to do travel writing. I mean, all that stuff is great and enjoyable, but you need some other things too that are a bit more solid and easier to come by. Because usually the things we want to do most are the things that either pay the least or are the most competitive to get into.
Mm. I think another common myth that people have is that as a freelancer, you don't have a boss.
Right.
Talk a little bit about how the client is boss and your reader is boss. And
I know I have about 15 bosses, but yeah. I mean, you are the boss, because you don't have to take the project. You get to negotiate the rate each time. That's not to say you're going to get what you want, but you have a lot more autonomy. You have the autonomy that your manager at your day job would have had. But you still have to keep these people happy. I mean, they're your customers, and you still have to, you know, make deadlines and follow directions. You can't just cop that attitude, well, I'm the talent, I'm the artist. I know you gave me these parameters, but I thought this would be better. I mean, that's not going to get you very far. You can think of them as bosses or you can think of them as customers, but they're people whose specifications you still need to meet.
Right, and check your ego at the door.
Yeah. I mean, within reason. You know, there are problem clients.
As I
talked about a lot in the book, and there's a lot of different ways of dealing with them, and a lot of times they don't know that they're being difficult. So there are diplomatic ways to say, you know, instead of sending me 100 emails throughout the week, perhaps we could have a one-hour meeting and go over all your concerns on Mondays, or, you know, whatever it is.
Right, right. I ran into that when I first freelanced. I had one fellow who would constantly call me, and you talk about setting boundaries and etc. And, you know, 11 o'clock at night, I was getting calls, and I was like, what is wrong with this person?
Yeah.
So I did just what you said and, you know, set those boundaries. Let's have a once a week. It didn't really stop him, but I didn't pick up the calls.
Yeah, you can train them subtly. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems new freelancers have, I think. And that's also, I think, one of the biggest misconceptions that clients have, that we're just available at a moment's notice to do something that might not be urgent, but, you know,
right,
that they want right now anyway.
Right. Now, you said that you know, a lot of business is involved too in being freelance. It's not like you just go out and do the creative work. There's the business side of things to do too. You talk in your book about selling, and I was really happy to see that, because I told you at the beginning of the show, so many freelance books never talk about selling, and it's such a huge component of a successful freelance business.
Yes.
We'd all like to have just word of mouth projects, and that does happen when you're established, but there's also selling involved, right?
Yes, and in fact, I talk about too how, you know, it's nice, it's, you can really do yourself a service by not just relying on word of mouth. I mean, sure, great things will come your way by word of mouth, but also if you target, you know, and actually cherry pick the projects and clients you want to work with, instead of just accepting everything that comes your way, you can have a lot more control over your freelance career and get, you know, meet your goals quite a bit faster than just sort of bouncing along from everything, you know, one job is offered to you to the next. But, Yeah, the selling. In the beginning, it might be half of your time because you need to drum up work and you need to do it any way possible, whether that's approaching, bigger bigger freelancers or, creative agencies that would subcontract to you or small businesses that might subcontract to you or, drumming up clients of your own in any way you can with the web, asking everyone you know, emailing people out of the blue, and then there's the follow-up, and then there's the pushing someone over the edge when they're sort of dragging their feet, things you can say to, is there anything I can do?
Right, right.
To help expedite your decision. And because there's that whole funny balance with freelancing that, somebody might say they want to hire you, but it's not a done deal until you get the work and you get the deposit, the cash deposit or the contract or, whatever you need to start the project. There's so many projects that mm-hmm. just don't get off the ground for various reasons.
There are many. And you take like 30% up front, I'm guessing.
That completely depends who I'm working for because, you cannot, it just doesn't work that way in, say, the newspaper world.
Right,
you get
definitely.
Paid when you turn in the work.
Yeah.
Or you have, I have certain arrangements with editors, some I bill like once a month or once every 2 weeks. But yeah, if it's if I'm working with an individual or a business that I may not have worked with before and I would prefer to, have at least a 50% deposit up front. Mm. Different people are comfortable with different things. If I'm working with, I do a lot of work with a certain big software company in this area and, I've worked with them on and off for more than a decade. And so I know they're good for the money and, there isn't a deposit situation involved with that work.
Right.
It's okay.
But it's especially important when it's a smaller company, you don't know the person.
Yes.
And I just had a friend actually get gypped out of all of her money, which was several thousand dollars. And I said, well, how much did you get up front? And she said nothing. And I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
Because at least she would have had something to fall back on then.
Yes. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, what about rates? Because oftentimes when you start out as a freelancer, you will go with whatever to get established.
I know.
And sometimes you can be working with a client and, you may still be working with them 2 years later and think, well, geez, I need to put my rates up because, I'm in a whole different place business-wise now. How do you approach that?
That's a whole big conversation, but it's important to look at what, the people comparable to you, people with the same level of experience and in the same geographic area and in the same industry and working for the same role and working for the same type of industries are making. And you can get that information by talking with other freelancers. You don't have to say, what are you making? But you could say, what would someone, working on a job like this make? What do people normally charge for a job like this? You can also go to professional organizations sometimes, like the Graphic Artist Guild or Media Bistro. Sometimes they gather, they'll do surveys of their members, books like The Writer's Market. They have average rates. So you're not completely shooting in the dark, but I also walk people through it in the book on how to, figure out how much you need to live on and then how much do you want to make and how much profit and, factor in your expenses and factor in how many days off you're going to take a year and then the freelance taxes and all that stuff. But
right.
So there are all different kinds of ways to figure that stuff out. But a real easy formula also is just to, I've heard people say they do it this way where if they know they need to make, I'm going to mess it up. you double... If you know you need to make $3,000 a month to cover all your personal and business expenses and taxes, you would probably want to charge double that because by the time you've paid your 25% to 30% taxes and all your, your own benefits, health insurance and everything,
right.
And then the business expenses, it kind of works out to be 50%
right.
of what you have charged.
Now, what about, I know that you sometimes have worked with agencies and you mentioned you work with, as a 1099, I assume, with a software company out here as a self-employed person. What about non-compete clauses?
Yes, I hate non-compete clauses.
Let's just explain what that is. It's like if say you're going to work somewhere, or even I've come across this when I first moved up here. One agent said, we won't send your resume out to any company unless you sign a non-compete. And then once we've sent your resume out to that company, even if they only send it once and they did not get a gig for me, I couldn't compete.
Oh, that's horrible. Company.
So I refused, obviously, to sign that.
Yeah.
But what's been your experience with...
Well, I mean, just to first answer your question, I think you've explained it well, but it would be when a client says, you know, you won't work with any of my competitors. And they're, you know... Sometimes there are reasonable requests on that. I mean, it's sort of understood in, say, Seattle that if you write for The Stranger, you won't write for the same article for the Seattle Weekly. I mean, that's just bad form.
Mm-hmm.
But I have encountered non-compete clauses with, you know, corporate clients, whether I'm working with a creative agency that is sending me to work with their client. And also I've encountered them with different websites and different, you know, traditional print media. And I always negotiate them, either negotiate the time frame down. If it says, you know, you will not work with our competitor for 6 months, well, how about three? But it just depends on the work you're doing. If you're only doing one little article for somebody, or, you know, one set of photos, or, you know, one quick consulting, it's completely unfair for them to say you won't work with anyone else.
Yeah.
Any of their competitors. Now, you know, with it's understandable if you go to a bigger firm and they're hiring you as a subcontractor to work with an established client of theirs. Basically, the non-compete is protecting them from you stealing their client from them. But, you know, it still has to be reasonable. If I have a client that If I have an agency that's going to send me to work for one of their clients, and their client is a, you know, 25,000 person company, and I may have my own contacts at that company, it's not fair to ask me to sign away my rights to work directly with that entire company. But it is fair to ask me to say that I won't work directly with their, like, one contact in that one department at that company for a year or whatever length.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. You explained that.
I mean, everything is negotiable. It doesn't hurt to try. And if a contract really doesn't sit well with you, don't do it. And there's great resources. I mean, for creative people, Washington Lawyers for the Arts has some real helpful. They have contract clinics that can be helpful. That's in Seattle, though.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the thing about contracts is that they are negotiable. Oftentimes people, you know, put this black and white document in front of us and we think we can't change it.
But, yeah.
But I think it's fairly standard to go through at some point and make some changes when you're negotiating.
Yes, I mean, often the person who gives you the contract doesn't even know what it says. It came from a lawyer. The lawyer has no idea what it's like to be in your position, you know, selling your work from project to project. And sometimes people will give you the song and dance, well, everybody signs this contract.
Mm-hmm. So as a freelancer, what if when you're giving advice to people, and I know a lot of people come to you for advice, what would you say is the biggest no-no, especially when somebody is first starting out?
The biggest no-no. Well, you know, I talked about don't quit your job, you know. Unless you have some way of financing your life for the next 6 to 12 months,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to take you a while to get started. But I think I hear from a lot of people, and I don't know, this isn't really a no-no, but it's a question I get asked a lot. Well, how could I possibly freelance on the side? I'm in an office between 8 and 5. You know, how can I contact clients and... but, you know, there are tons of people moonlighting evenings and weekends, and so much. I think people who aren't yet working for themselves don't understand that most independent professionals have never met a majority of the people they work with. Now, that's not going to be true for a massage therapist or maybe a business consultant who meets you face-to-face, but, you know, all the people providing, like, a service that can be done online, whether it's a virtual assistant or a designer or a web programmer, We have clients we've often never met, even if they're in the same town as us, because everything's done by email. And so you can be emailing, people you're, you know, making first contact with them, and you could send it from your lunch hour, from your own email account, not your work email account.
Right.
You know, even better if you have your own, you know, computer or mobile device. But you can be doing all that stuff after hours. You know, it's not a matter of, oh, I have to be there for an 11 a.m. meeting anymore. I mean, the web makes it so much easier. So I think maybe that's a big misconception. And a big mistake is probably spending way more money than you need to spend right off the bat. I talked about how when I first was a freelancer, I was so excited that I went into Office Depot and charged up, you know, all kinds of things that I still have 15 years later. You know, and you really do want to spend as little money as possible.
Right. So keep it simple until the money starts coming in. Michelle Goodman, thank you so much for the advice you've shared with us today.
Thank you, too.
I want you to give out your website.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
It's anti9to5guide.com. And the 9 and 5 are numbers.
Okay. The anti, and no, it's just anti, right?
Anti9to5guide.com.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, too. And
yeah, my guest, Michelle Goodman, her both of her books, The Anti-9-to-5 Guide, Practical Career Advice for Women Who Think Outside the Cube, as in cubicle, and My So-Called Freelance Life is her new book, How to Survive and Thrive as a Creative Professional for Hire. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with photojournalist, visual storyteller, and filmmaker Marcus Donner. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for new fiction authors? Or a different kind of book? For good writing that challenges the mind, the heart, the spirit? Then check out Book Talk Podcasting at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk brings you weekly bite-sized book reviews brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. You can listen to Book Talk Podcasts at 1150kknw.com or anytime by downloading them to your MP3 player. If you'd like to try your hand at submitting a review, email info@conversationslive.net for more information. To listen to Book Talk, go to 1150kknw.com and click on podcasting. It's that simple.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And today it's the third Monday of the month, so we are talking about alternative career options, viable lifestyles. And today we're talking specifically about what it takes to create a freelance lifestyle. And my second guest is a freelance journalist, visual storyteller, and filmmaker. He's Marcus Donner and has been shooting professionally for over 20 years. His work has appeared around the world in publications and web outlets served by the Associated Press and Reuters to the Sundance Channel and HBO Cinemax. And welcome, Marcus Donner, welcome.
good to be with you, Vicky.
And Marcus, you're also local right here in Seattle, and that's you know, that's good because we can get to hear firsthand what the market's like here again. So I know your story is a little different to Michelle's. I wonder if you'd tell us how you got into freelancing, what you were doing before.
Before I was a freelancer, I was a staff photographer and then the director of photography for the now defunct King County Journal newspapers, the former Journal American paper in Bellevue. And like, unfortunately, many papers today, it closed in 2007. So I didn't really get to choose to be a freelance. It was sort of chosen for me.
Mm. So tell us what happened. You get your pink slip with everybody else. And did freelancing seem automatic to you at that point? Or
We probably knew, you know, there was many bad signs that the paper wasn't doing well, you know, 9 months before the paper actually closed. And so a little bit like Michelle mentioned, at that time I started to cut expenses and put more in the bank, not knowing what the future was going to hold. And when the paper closed, I did spend about 3 months looking for a new job as a photo editor, but there just aren't that many jobs anymore. You know, the trend is not growing. It's it's going the other way. And so after 3 months, I just decided instead of just banging my head against the wall, I would just go freelance. And having worked here for 20 years, I had 20 years of contacts to draw on. And I just started talking to anybody I could that I was going to go freelance and putting that sort of idea in their head.
Mm. Now, 20 years of contacts is invaluable, I would think. How easy was it for you to start freelancing?
I think it was less difficult than some because many people that know me have moved on to have worked with me at the paper or another or on films have moved on to other places. And, I would get offers like on the film side. I could only do it very selectively because I had to use my like vacation or shoots on weekends. But basically, once I told people I was available all the time, offers came in that they had never asked before because they knew I had a staff job. Mm-hmm. And the same with some of the media outlets, the AP staff photographers. I worked with them for, as long as they've been in Seattle, and also the Reuters photographers. And so they knew they couldn't ask me before. And now, just telling them that I was available really helped. But it is a lot of work. You do have to market yourself all the time.
I was going to ask you about networking and how, other than just working with people, and how do you go about networking as a freelance photographer, photojournalist, filmmaker?
I try to a lot of different things. I try to talk to people all the time. Anytime I'm at an event with other photographers or other filmmakers, I will always say that I'm freelance. I always have cards in my pocket. If I'm on many things like a local video shoot, most of the people there are freelancers. Most of the other crew, the grips and the electric and the makeup and all that, they work on things too. And so if you network with them, they're going to be in a job where they go, oh, we need a still photographer. And that's going to help you out. And then I try to do, since I'm a photographer, some innovative things. So anybody that I shot an assignment for last year at Christmas, at the holiday time, I made 3D holiday cards and sent them out with 3D glasses.
Cool.
Figuring people would not forget me that way.
Right. That's novel anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to remind clients that you're still out there.
Yeah. Yeah, relationship, it's all about relationship building, isn't it? I think so many people have the misconception that when you freelance, you just lock yourself away and work on your projects.
Oh, no, it's far from that. I do work at my desk a lot, but and like I said, sometimes it's just talking to clients, even if you know they don't have any work for you this month. It's just to chat with them and see how they are and remind them that you're out there so that when something comes up, they remember to call you.
Yeah. I obviously work in a different field to you, but we kind of cross a little because I do work in film. But I sometimes see an article that I think a certain person might be interested in, and I'll just clip it or photocopy it and send it off to them with a little post-it stuck on. I think that's a good way of staying in touch, too.
Yeah, that's a fantastic way. Anytime I see things that I think would tip somebody's interest, I will pass it on.
Now, when you first started freelancing, you'd been a staffer you'd been on staff for 20 years. You'd
yeah.
been director of photography. What were the biggest challenges for you?
Some of them are things you really take for granted when you're a staffer. When you're a staffer, all you have to do is fill your time card in, and the check comes back. But
right.
When you're a freelancer, all of a sudden you have to do the billing, and you have to send out the invoices, and now you have to keep track of expenses you never thought you'd have to keep track of, like how much did I spend on photocopy paper and all those sort of small things. That it's not just doing the job of being a photographer or a filmmaker, you're also the the back office, you're also the accountant and the shipping and receiving and the just everything. And it takes a lot more time than you might imagine.
Yes, definitely. And what have you found to be the biggest pleasant surprise, the biggest benefit, if you like?
The biggest benefit is, I do get a wider variety of work than I had when I was a staffer. I have, how I got working on the film side is I was a photographer, but I had childhood friends that work in film, and I could only work on their project very, very rarely, but it was very enjoyable work. But once I was freelance, I can take a lot more of that work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a much more interesting balance of things to do. Whereas as a staffer, I could never do as much as I'm doing now.
Right. So as a staffer, you would have been sent out. Well, you were director of photography, so I'm guessing you actually selected some of
I actually sent other people out on assignments and
right.
edited the photos to put in the paper.
Okay. And so how are the projects different that you work on now? What kind of projects do you work on now?
Oh, it's almost all photography now. Although I love being the photo editor, I never did really imagine I'd retire as a photo editor. So now I get to, indulge my creative side just all the time. And that's it's a much more enjoyable. And so I don't really miss now having that photo desk job.
Mm. You've captured some great photographs. I'm thinking of one on your website with the Dalai Lama, and you say that you caught him, the Dalai Lama, fist bumping with Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
What have been some of your favorite shoots?
Oh, it's always so hard for staffers to pick favorites because, we're always looking on how to make the next best photo. But that's certainly one of them. Part of the joy of being a photojournalist is, it's a cliche, but you do get to witness, history firsthand.
Right.
Seeing that sort of unguarded moment by the Dalai Lama is a real neat memory because, you think of him as such a serious person, but he has a fantastic sense of humor, and that came. I covered 3 days of those events, and his sense of humor came out all the time.
Yeah. I shouldn't say this because I'm a writer, but I think of, that cliche, a picture says 1,000 words. It's so true.
Yeah.
So true. Some of our best lessons, some of our most powerful lessons come from lessons that we had to learn the hard way. What have you had to learn the hard way, Marcus, and how has that helped you grow as a freelancer?
Yeah, certainly some of the things that Michelle mentioned earlier. You do really want to know the details of, how the contracts are going to be executed and how you're going to get paid. Because sometimes it's taken much longer than I could have imagined. And every publication is different. But I had one where it took 3 months to get paid because the PR company that hired me didn't really say that the client from overseas would be paying me directly.
Oh, gosh.
Everything seemed perfectly good in the paperwork, except for that slight notation that they were just going to pass the invoice on, across the Pacific.
Yeah, and that's that can be, I think cash flow is probably one of the biggest challenges when you first start out, because, and especially when you've been a staffer for so long, you know, I worked in the corporate world for many years before I went freelance, and you're so used to having that, you know, bi-weekly or monthly paycheck just pop in your inbox there.
Yeah, and that is a big one, and you do have to sort of realize that what you're doing now is not the paycheck that's going to arrive this week; it's the paychecks from what you did last month. Mm. You know, there's always a time lag, and especially in publications, and some are very, especially like if you do magazine work, you know, often you get paid on publication.
Right.
So you have to anticipate that this is a great gig, but when does it publish? Oh, this doesn't publish till spring.
Right.
You know,
right. So you don't get paid till spring then?
Yes.
Do you ever, you know, I have a friend whose husband makes well over $1 million a year in his business. He's a welder, nothing to do with freelancing. But he lies awake at night sometimes wondering where their next project is going, and he makes tons of money. Do you ever find yourself in that situation? Do you lie awake sometimes and think, did I do the right thing? I know Michelle said that there are times that she thought she should get out.
You know, it's only been about a year and a half, so I haven't got to that point yet. You know, I do more worry about building business up more and more. I do, as Michelle mentioned, I don't just do one segment. I have many many clients and different things. Sometimes I'm shooting journalism, like for Reuters or the AP, but sometimes it's just classic portraiture. People need nice location pictures, and journalists are excellent at that. I do work in film, and then I do teaching. And so I'm always looking for, that's like, you know, four major areas. Can I make it five major areas?
Right.
Because the more of them that there are, the more chance that you will always have a steady stream that particular month.
Right.
Makes it less worrisome.
Yeah, makes sense. Good segue, actually, into, you just mentioned teaching, and I actually met you when you were teaching a class on photography for the Society of Professional Journalists, and you are actually going to be teaching a workshop in Rome. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm collaborating with a travel writing colleague of mine, Amanda Castleman, who is teaching a travel writing class, and because it is now the 21st century, and unfortunately, most starting out freelancers and many publications, reporters have to shoot their own pictures. There was a real need to teach reporters some basic photography skills, things that they probably never realized that they would need, but get asked to do all the time. So Amanda had an online class that we took into the real world. And so we'll spend a week in Rome in May, teaching aspiring travel writers about travel writing and photography.
And what fun, you get to hang out in Rome afterwards.
Yes, and you know, a good bit of the class time is not in a classroom, but you know, out in the field, putting the things you just learned into practice, which is it's so much more fun and inspiring to learn some new skill and then be able to just walk outdoors and there's the Colosseum.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful place, too.
Yeah.
We're almost at the end of the show. What's the best piece of advice you can give to someone who might be thinking about heading into the freelance life?
I think the best thing would be not to do it overnight, you know, to plan for it, to, you know, start thinking about what resources could you tap that are lying there untapped, and how many different ways you can use the skills that you have. I use my skills as a photographer in at least four or five different ways. Often when you're a staffer, you're just like, I just do this one job. Maybe the skill you have can be translated over half a dozen or a dozen different fields, mm-hmm. you know, different areas.
Yeah. So diversify, don't pigeonhole yourself.
Yeah, do not pigeonhole yourself. You do have to be diverse.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your journey with us. Let's give out your website, Marcus, where people can find you.
My website is pretty simple. It's just my name, marcusdonner.com. And if they want to learn about the travel class, it's travelwritingclass.com.
Okay, so travelwritingclass.com and Marcus Donner. Marcus Donner is spelled D-O-N-N-E-R.
That's right.
Marcus, thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I want to thank each of you for being with us today. As always, you can reach me if you want to give feedback or have questions on today's show. Reach me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. 7617, or you can reach me through our website at conversationslive.net. And don't forget to check out Book Talk podcast this week. We actually, Cynthia reviewed Terry Brooks' trilogy, and I think it's called The Genesis of Shannara. So that's on 1150kknw.com. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong, and thanks for spending this hour with us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Coming Monday, December 1st, on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Reverend Maria Dancing Heart shares her views on the last adventure of life. She says dying can be a cause for joy, and the truth is that letting go is liberating. Maria Dancing Heart explores new ways to view spirituality and death. She'll discuss the power of trust to heal and how love is the only real power any of us have. We'll also be talking to Catherine Neville, best-selling author of The Eight, about her new novel, The Fire, and why it took 20 years to write. That's all coming Monday, December 1st at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Views